This episode is brought to you by Seminary Now. Seminary Now is a streaming video platform that delivers exclusive biblical, theological, and practical ministry training. You'll find many of the authors and professors you know and love, including previous guests on this show like Scott McKnight and Brenda Salter McNeil. There are so many amazing scholars and guides to help you engage the Bible and equip you in your faith. You'll even find my video course on managing anxiety on Seminary Now. They release new courses every month, and for just $20 a month, you can get access to all of it. And we've got a special offer for our listeners for the Managing Leadership Anxiety podcast. You can get 30% off. Just go to seminarynow.com/cuss and use code CUSS30 at the checkout for your discount.
You're listening to Managing Leadership Anxiety, Yours and Theirs, a podcast offered in partnership with Missio Alliance. Each episode, we discuss internal and relational pressures, how they block effective leadership, and how we can move through them to a greater health. And now your host, Steve Cuss.
Friends, technically a solo episode today. Jimmy Carnes is with me to wrap up this series of the four dynamics. We'll get to that. But of course, like all of you, I've been reflecting on Israel and Palestine and Hamas. And I guess my word, we're going to light our candle. I'm going to read a psalm today. I think the word I have on it is, I think it's hard for us to sit in horror and in the horror of violence and evil. I mean, it's way beyond tragedy. We're talking the amount of innocent people being killed or affected by it. And I think what happens is we're too anxious to sit in the horror, so we have to have an opinion on it. We're kind of forced to comfort ourselves. We have to have an opinion. We have to draw a line. And so I'm just going to invite us instead to lament. So today's candle lighting, we have our three-wick candle here. This is the Capable Life candle, the eucalyptus mint candle. And just an invitation to lament horror and to recognize that there will come a day where God will make all wrongs right and there'll be no more pain. And I was thinking about just reading us a psalm to get started. And it occurred to me that I don't treat the Psalms evenly. I kind of have three or four that are just go-tos for me, and this is one of them, Psalm 46. God is our refuge and strength, a helper who is always found in times of trouble. Therefore, we will not be afraid, though the earth trembles and the mountains topple into the depths of the seas, though its waters roar and foam, and the mountains quake with its turmoil. There is a river, and its streams delight the city of God, the holy dwelling place of the Most High. God is within her, she will not be toppled. God will help her when the morning dawns. Nations rage, kingdoms topple, the earth melts when he lifts his voice. The Lord of armies is with us, the God of Jacob is our stronghold. Come, see the works of the Lord who brings devastation on the earth. He makes wars cease throughout the earth. He shatters bows and he cuts spears to pieces. He sets wagons ablaze. Stop fighting and know that I am God, exalted among the nations, exalted on the earth. The Lord of armies is with us. The God of Jacob is our stronghold. Just before we get into our dynamics today, obviously it's intense. And I think of two quotes. I think of Teresa of Avila, where she says, "All shall be well and all manner of things shall be well." And, you know, I hear that quote and I get some comfort from it, but I also frankly find it confusing. And that's why I find Mandy Smith helpful. She added an addendum to Teresa of Avila. Mandy Smith says, "Living in this reality requires the broadest possible definition of all and well." And that helps me stomach Teresa a little more. Jimmy, here we go. The four dynamics. We're going to take a hard shift. How about if you just catch us up on where we've been and what we're doing today?
Yeah, sounds good. Man, that is a hard shift. I'm still kind of reeling. And not only that scripture, but these quotes. So, All right. We have been talking about four dynamics. So assumptions, reactivity, stuck problems, and attempted solutions. And today we're going to talk about the fourth one, but just a quick recap of the first three. We talked about, over the past three episodes, assumptions. These are the things that we just assume is true about the world around us. Of course, sometimes they're true, but they're not all the time true. And if we can take a look at these and name them, then we can be better prepared to recognize how we automatically show up. And the next one's reactivity. This is when you go from 0 to 100 in an instant. It's these values violations or these things that make us reactive. We get bigger, we get smaller. There are ways that you can pay attention to how we get reactive. And then the third one was stuck problems. This is a really interesting one because we all have problems, but it is important to delineate the difference between just regular problems and stuck problems, the ones that we find ourselves in over and over again, to where our attempted solutions are actually what make them worse and entrenched. And so that actually is what brings us to today. We're going to talk about those attempted solutions.
Yeah, attempted solutions. This is really part of the genius of systems theory. And for those who are systems theory nerds, this isn't so much from the Bowen stream. This is from the Bateson stream, the Mental Research Institute guys. We chat about these guys all the time on Capable Life, but what's interesting is they're actually not particularly well known in the systems world, but it was Jay Haley. I love the way he said it. When people would come in for counseling and they would say, here's my problem, he would say, oh, I don't treat problems, I treat attempted solutions.
Yeah.
And just that idea of shifting your focus off the problem to your best and well-meaning effort to fix it that might in fact be keeping it going or making it worse, it's genius.
Oh, yeah.
I remember reading about it in the, I think, late 90s for me. I was in seminary. I had this amazing seminary professor, Jack Holland, and he was a systems guy. And I came in with all my Bowen from chaplaincy. And he's like, let me take you on a wild ride. And he's the one that introduced me to all these other streams. I'm forever grateful to Jack. But attempted solutions, I remember I was like, oh, crap. Because I could just immediately, as soon as they said it, I got it.
Yeah.
Maybe we could start, Jimmy, by, okay, what does a problem look like versus a stuck problem? Like, how do you know if something's just a problem versus a stuck problem? What are you looking at, or what comes to mind for you?
Yeah, I think it's that there's a predictable pattern to it. It's almost like one of those things that you can set your watch by. And then it's where when you find yourself in a problem and you try to do something about it, because I think that all of us don't generally just sit in our problems. We try and do something about them.
Yeah.
And inevitably, because of the way that we're all wired differently, there are these certain kind of areas that we find ourselves stuck, to where the tools that we have at our disposal, maybe our automatic reactions or whatever it might be, you end up just using more gas. You just keep applying the same solution to the problem, expecting it to suddenly go away. But inevitably, those attempted solutions are actually what's keeping it stuck or even making it worse.
Yeah. And it's almost like you're so focused on it, you're not able to lift your head and see the pattern. You don't realize necessarily you're doing more of the same. I'm thinking about the last episode we did where we talked about the children's worker, where the problem was a volunteer always canceling late.
Mm-hmm.
And because of her need for everyone to be okay, her attempted solution was to ensure he understood that it wasn't a big deal at all.
Yeah.
And then she was quite alarmed to realize that she's actually part of the problem, because she was so anxious she may not have even known she was anxious at all. That's not an uncommon situation. I know in my life, it's shocking when I suddenly lift my head and realize, holy smokes, I've been trying to apply a solution for months or years.
Yeah, it's really interesting, because when you mentioned it just a few minutes ago, when you were introduced to this idea to, versus problems versus attempted solutions with Jay Haley, is it flips the focus, right? Like we tend to focus on the problem and are blind to the other side of that equation. And this is I think that's some of the magic to it, is it allows you to focus on what you're doing, like what are observing yourself and your actions or reactions to the problem. And that's where we all know that we can't change very much. It's outside of us. So it's really helpful to focus on the things that we can do.
Yeah. Some of our favorite iconic historical leaders just naturally are good at this. That's what's fascinating to me.
Mm.
I think of like Winston Churchill. You know, he's voted to be Prime Minister of England by his political enemies to basically kill his political career. And they're doing this within 10 days to 14 days of Germany about to invade England. Like, they don't seem as concerned that they're all going to start speaking German. They're just trying to like defeat Churchill.
Yeah.
And then he does the counterintuitive move of bringing all his harshest enemies onto his war cabinet, things like that. I don't know that Steve Jobs is someone we want to model everything after, but I do think of when he came back to Apple and they were sinking so fast and he started to bring changes and the board started to resist his changes.
Yeah.
And a lot of times the attempted solution would be to explain yourself more, but he never got caught up in it, because partly because he's just Steve Jobs. He doesn't care what other people think.
Sure.
But he, in that case, an example would be he could see right away they're stuck. I'm not stuck. So he just doubled down on them, very Steve Jobs move, and said, oh, this decision that you think is so big is tiny. This decision I'm making is inconsequential. If you're getting stuck on this, you probably should all resign. Like, now, very aggressive, but in his credit, in the plus column, Apple required a nimble leader.
Yeah.
And there is something about noticing the patterns that make you less likely to get wrapped up in them, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really interesting, my brain is going a bunch of different ways, but yeah, there is something about those people that we can look at and their career, let's say, and lots of different books and things have tried to figure out the magic, right?
Yeah.
Of what makes a leader effective, and there's all these different conclusions, but yeah, totally one of them is just the way they go about thinking about things, as they don't tend to get so hyper-focused and stuck on some of the things that we might get stuck on ourselves.
Yeah. Yeah, we'll get into some of the signs. In fact, let's get into them now. Some of the signs of stuckness. Why don't we begin with imaginative gridlock? Because that is what Jobs and Churchill and Abraham Lincoln, I'm thinking of Lincoln at the end of the Civil War, that defeated the South.
Mm-hmm.
And Lincoln's political allies are saying, let's now prosecute and kill some of the generals.
Yeah.
And Lincoln's like, no. Again, that he wasn't in that more of the same. Lincoln's like, no, we've shed more blood than we'd ever want to shed. We're going to actually set people free and let them live their lives. And so imaginative gridlock is one of the things that gets us in stuck patterns. And some of these great leaders, somehow, they're able to stay above anxiety to see things.
Yeah, I think the other dynamic too is not just maybe a wiring or an ability to be above it or beyond it, but that's why I think it's so important. You mentioned last podcast or the one before it of the church and the nursery and the kitchen and
right.
the flip. And when Tom came in to flip that, not only is Tom wired that way
right.
to think that way, but he also wasn't a part of all the conversations that kept you stuck, right?
Yeah.
And so when we look at family of origin stuff, like the family propaganda, the way we were raised or the culture we're in, there's these things that make us look at the world in a particular way. And sometimes the way out is to bring in somebody that doesn't think that way, that isn't under the same assumptions and, you know, propaganda. That's why I think some of the work we do, what some of the magic is that when you get somebody who's describing their emotional reactivity, let's say, on a particular situation, because those of us who are in a circle with them to help them process through it aren't in that situation with them, we can automatically be more objective and help broaden the horizons, I think. Yeah.
About what some of our favorite ways of noticing stuckness. Talk to us about more of the same and try harder.
Yeah, I mean, one that I am still a slave to is when I think that I'm not coming across clearly. More of the same and try harder for me looks like using more words. I think that I'm going to climb myself out of by using more words. Yeah, I don't know if that's where you were going with this, but that's where my mind went immediately.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I'm thinking of also over-functioning. We talk off and on this show about over-functioning and under-functioning. That if we talk about that children's worker again, she so anxiously needs people to be okay. She resolves all the tension of someone canceling late. That's over-functioning.
Yeah.
And so now she's stuck. And until she can manage the pain of correctly functioning, which is going to hurt for her more because she's been over-functioning probably most of her life, right?
Yeah.
As two over-functioners talking to each other right now, I'm very familiar with this. It's really wild how naturally I just fall into over-functioning and how uncomfortable it is to let something be.
Yeah, and I think that the other commonality between the two of us is we don't like to – our tolerance for being stuck has gotten really short over the years. I'm less tolerant of myself staying stuck than I used to be.
Yeah.
I think that's just these tools and being in them for so long. But because of that, it also means that means I'm going to continue to try and do something. I'm also a doer, right? We all have different wiring. Some people are thinkers and feelers, but I'm primarily a doer. And one of the signs of stuckness is that it's almost a hyperactive doing that can look different. It can look like, oh man, I'm actually trying all these different solutions, but then you get somebody to help you think through it. And what ends up you realizing is that they're actually all the same. They're all different versions of the same solution.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. It's like a meta. I'm not sure I'm trying to think in real time as you shared that. Like one of my ongoing patterns was trying to win over my harsh critics, for example.
Yeah.
And I'm just trying to think, okay, did it apply there? And I think what you're saying did apply because it felt to me like my solutions were different. Sometimes I would meet with them. Sometimes I would email. But in the meta level, my problem was trying to get them to agree with me and like me.
Exactly.
And so then my attempted solutions might look different, but were all in that common theme. So I guess, is that true? You're trying to notice the common, what is it, theme or need?
Yeah, I think it's probably need. That's one of the things that we explore in Capable Life, or what are the things that you think you need that you don't actually need? It's not about becoming needless, right? It's about trying to figure out these things that you must have to be okay, right? That if you have this need to be understood, let's say, then that's what you're trying to make sure that, well, you must not understand me, right? If you're critiquing what I brought, then you must not understand what I meant by it, right? Could be what's behind that.
Yeah. And so this is where, when we talk about stuck patterns and attempted solutions, it always gets nuanced because someone could be listening to this and saying, well, what could possibly be wrong with being courteous and explaining yourself to a critic? Mm. And what could be wrong when a volunteer cancels that you appease their anxiety? Mm-hmm. So that would then be the difference between a problem and a stuck problem, right?
Totally.
What are you hearing there?
Yeah, I think that I'm reminded that, you know, these different, I keep using the word proclivities, and maybe I don't even know what that word means, but it's these tendencies that we have aren't problematic if we have a variety of tools or things that we do, but they become problematic when they're our go-to or we're doing them in an unknowing way. Like, I don't even realize that I'm doing this to feed this need of mine.
Yeah.
It's a big difference once you notice that it's a need and you can temper it versus letting it just blindly drive the way that you show up. I think that's the difference.
Yeah. So if you're listening to this and you're trying to get clear on, okay, when is it okay to explain myself and when am I falling into it? Mm-hmm. I think what we're trying to coach people is to pay attention to your heart motive. And is it actually for the sake of the kingdom or is it to appease yourself? That's not easy to answer, but it's worthwhile asking. Okay, so in my case with critics, I don't know. I mean, in a church with hundreds of adults, there's probably dozens that want me to know their opinion. And so the best thing to do is to meet with those people, listen to them, share my view. And then, for gosh, Jimmy, 80 to 95% of them, we shake on it.
Yeah.
Whether I have won them over, whether they agree, many times as not, they disagree, but there's no anxiety there. That feels to me like, oh, that's a kingdom endeavor. It's courteous of me to give them my time, give them my insight. They give me theirs. And then actually, I would have to say, as we push this episode a bit, differentiation has been a game changer for me because I no longer need them to agree with me for us to be well with each other.
Yeah. Well, and I was wondering if we should go there too, not necessarily the term differentiation, but this idea of tolerating dissonance.
Yeah. You know, I think defining myself.
Yeah. Your ability, you know, because you are a well-differentiated leader, is your ability to stay connected with people when having difference of opinion or dissonance. That is what calms everything down because in all of this, you know, we're a chronically anxious society. And because I can't handle dissonance, I then have to create us and them, right? Yeah. There has to be distance and divide in order to huddle up with the people who think and act like I do.
Yeah. Yeah. So the prime example for me, like I've got so many examples where I did it badly, but one where I did it well was when our church was doing neighborhood meetings for affordable housing. And I became a bit of the lightning rod or the poster child for some neighbors convinced that I'm single-handedly ruining their property values, things like this.
Yeah.
And yet some of our neighbors also were church members, and it was a move of differentiation. My typical anxiety would need everyone to like me or agree with me, but a connected, differentiated self got up and said, if you're a neighbor and a church member, you're probably under a lot of pressure of your convictions, your neighbor's convictions in our churches. You should vote no and then come Sunday and worship, no problem.
Yeah.
And that would be an extreme example. And it's when you say that, it sounds like, oh, what a great leader. It's also out of self-interest.
Right.
So it protects me from getting petty or anxious as well.
Yeah.
Okay, so now we're getting into the difference. So you have your run-of-the-mill critic and you meet and you resolve or you don't resolve, and that's fine. But then you have what we call usual suspect critics that because I'm so anxious to win them over, I don't see that they actually want to stay at odds with me. Like they've got a vested interest, right? I remember doing a workshop once for some local politicians, very unusual for me. And it was mind-blowing to them that they actually cannot win over half of their constituents.
Right.
But they were in that more of the same try harder pattern and saying, wait, just by definition, because you're a Democrat, the Republicans won't want to hear from you, you know, this kind of idea. And so then if we go to our children's worker, you know, one person cancels one time and she says, no problem, things happen. That feels healthy.
Yeah.
But anxiously needing to always do it feels like a stuck pattern. Sounds subtle. Do you think that's clear for people, or do we need to dig into that more?
I hope so. My brain was distracted with when I was in sales for a while. I actually did door-to-door sales, and I remember
encyclopedias, if I remember right.
It wasn't encyclopedias. Everybody thinks it's encyclopedias. There
Why
were
did
books
I think that
I don't know. I mean, because there are a lot of encyclopedia door-to-door sales. Sure, I think that's I was just put in that category, right? You assume there were books to help kids out with schoolwork. Anyhow, that's a different story. The point of this story is that I think somewhere in sales school, we were told about the percentages of some percentage of people are just buyers and some percentage of people just won't buy no matter what it is. So you could be giving away free bags of gold and they won't take it.
Yeah.
You know, and then the opposite side of the spectrum is you could be, you know, selling bags of poo and, you know, they'll just buy it. Yeah. Right. But most people are somewhere in the middle. And I think that, I mean, it's not a very helpful anecdote for here, except that there is just this, you can relax into this idea of, man, it has nothing to do with me, right? When I was trying to, let's say, sell something and I would meet one of those people that just aren't going to buy no matter what, it helped take some of the pressure off of what my expectations are of what success looked like. And I think that that kind of thing happens in this conversation, you know, with the critics of recognizing, you know, that there's a small constituency that you don't even realize that's just actually what is why they're in this relationship,
that's
right?
That's right. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Like I'm I don't know what the right metaphor is, but I'm required. They need someone to kick so that they can feel better. But something that occurred to me as you were saying that, we've never talked about this, and I may now add this as a sign of stuckness when you're taking something personally that's actually not personal. I wonder if that might help. And whether you're a people pleaser like me, or sometimes what you take personally, for example, for pastors, is people's spiritual growth. If they're not behaving the way you want them to or whatever, it may not be that you want them to like you. You just get annoyed.
Yeah.
But either way, I wonder if that's a sign. Like that when you were talking about, look, I knock on the door and the answer is no, it's not about me.
Yeah.
That feels a way to stay unstuck.
Well, I don't know, this episode is getting quite complicated because we're bouncing around, but while we're on this topic, so many of these things are easiest to notice in the extremes, right? So yeah. You can notice an extreme when you're taking something personal that has nothing to do with you. But on the other side of the spectrum, it's demonizing or dehumanizing people in order, because that's the only way that you can feel not attacked, let's say, or safe yourself. Yeah. And so it's either of those things you can start to notice. But, you know, obviously this life that we've been called to, I think the life of freedom that God talks about is one that's not on the edges of these extremes, right?
Yeah. Okay. So let's see if we can help people with some pithy examples of a stuck pattern or a recurring problem, and then the attempted solutions. I'll go first. The recurring problem is my son is always late in the morning for school, and my attempted solution is I will make his lunch for him and then have an anger fantasy when he leaves. He'll go out the door and I'll be grumpy in my brain. That would be a simple stuck pattern where my attempted solution is keeping the problem going.
Yeah, man. Well, my example will be hopefully pithy, but I'm going to make it more generic so I don't throw anybody under the bus. But in a scenario of having either residents or direct reports and finding myself caring more about their success than they do.
Yeah.
And so it seems like it was always a different solution. It looked different, it seemed. But the recurring pattern was I would try another way to either equip them or come alongside them and then get frustrated when the target wasn't hit or something wouldn't happen. Then I would get upset and angry. And all the anger would do would just motivate me to try even harder. I must not be doing it right. I must be able to take it a different angle maybe. You know, I must not be a very good leader.
I think we're onto something with this taking it personally as a sign.
Yeah.
Because, like if somebody is just stunningly indifferent, your brain says, well, obviously, like I'm good at developing people. I must not be developing them properly.
Sure, yeah. There's all these conclusions, you know, that you make.
Yeah. A recurring pattern of behavior is angry email from a congregant where we've met 5 times to resolve in the last 3 years. My attempted solution, one more meeting will get the job done.
Yeah.
You know, we'll finally win them over. That would be another one for me. Let's see, with our children's worker, recurring problem is same volunteer always cancels last minute. My attempted solution is to make sure they don't feel bad about it. And then I go away feeling bad. And then in this particular person's case, then my spouse gets grumpy because I've been over-responsible. That would be another X and Y.
I think of Friedman's fable. I don't remember the title of it, but it's about the guy who believes that he's dead. These people keep coming and trying to, you know, basically argue with logic or whatever it is to convince him that he's alive. And I think that for me, that's another example of when you find somebody that isn't moving towards you or doesn't want to be well, and you or a group of friends, you know, whatever it is, you continue to think, man, if I could just, how could I say it that'll get through to them, right? That's that more of the same try harder and not understanding that. You know, it's almost like the critic, right? All these ones that you're trying to do to make them understand you, and you've not realized that the whole game is Steve loses, maybe.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Okay. So let's see. One of the things you've mentioned about what's fascinating about attempted solutions is the problem with them is sometimes they work.
Yeah.
Tell us more about that.
Can I tell them about the switch on your wall? Is that fair?
Oh, yeah, with my fireplace.
Yeah, that's what brought it up is that you've got a fireplace switch. You just moved into a new house, and if you hit it hard enough, I think, then it switches on, right, sometimes.
I think so. I'm still trying to figure out. I can't tell if there's a safety thing with the gas, but my assumption is that the switch needs to be hit.
And so you hit it a few times and go, man, maybe that isn't what does it. But then one more time and it turns on.
And I hit it harder, more of the same and try harder. You watch me do it.
Yeah. I mean, that's so important to realize that. I think that's one of the reasons why we do stay stuck is that sometimes these attempted solutions do work, right? And it's like, how do you know? What was that quote that you said earlier? We were talking about magic.
Andy Stanley says the problem with magic is all magic works some of the time. And that's why people believe in magic and superstition, because it occasionally pays off. It's a brilliant observation. Yeah, even with a fireplace, it's a good metaphor. So we're on the main floor of my house, a bit chilly. I'm like, oh, it'd be nice to have a fire. Can't get my switch to work. I'm also a little mortified in public. Like, you're there and I'm like, oh, I should be, because I'm a man of the house. I should have fixed it. What's interesting is I don't step out of the solution. This could describe my handyman approach in general, that maybe changing the switch is one trip to Home Depot and maybe half an hour of work. That would actually either resolve the problem or prove that it's not the switch.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just on the treadmill of more of the same and try harder. And so what's going on is my pain tolerance for hitting the switch is not high enough. I don't know. I may not be saying it right. But the pain of getting to the store and taking the time to fix it is too high. Yeah. Therefore, I stay stuck.
Yeah. Yeah. And that has so much to do with, you know, our wiring too. Because of the way that I'm wired, I actually really struggle to do the same broken thing more than three or four times.
So you would have gone to Home Depot by now, because I've had this fireplace since February.
Yeah, but I mean, it's just a difference in what drives us, right? Yeah. It doesn't say anything more than that, because my efficiency isn't great, right? Because I'll often spend two to three times the amount of time it would take to just do the broken thing, to fix the broken thing, so I'll never have to do it again.
Yeah.
I don't know that it would ever even, like, let's say it would take me 3 hours to fix it and it takes me 10 seconds to deal with this broken thing over and over. It may take 5 years for me to get back that time. Yeah. So from strictly a time efficiency, it's not productive, but for my own well-being, it's something that drives me.
All right. So at the top of the episode, when we're talking about Hamas and Israel, I just made the comment that I think because we struggle to sit in horror, we anxiously need to have an opinion. Here's something I just want our listeners to think about, because all of the things we teach on this show are about managing anxiety so that you can be well and so you can connect to God. And in many ways, in our theology, the chief competitor of God is self. So hopefully, listeners, you can go on this shift with us. But our attempted solution to the recurring problem of our anxiety is self. That's what I would say in a nutshell. Because we can't manage our anxiety, it's not that we naturally give it to God, we move deeper into self. And so what I want us to think about, this is more of a philosophical thing that you can explore, is you can notice yourself moving into self when you go into self-pity or when you go into self-righteousness. I kind of see these as like two opposite boundaries. If I'm in a field and it's like a 20-acre field, then if I go on the fence on one side, I've hit self-pity. And if I walk the 20 acres and go on the other side, I've hit self-righteousness. I think a lot of what's going on with our struggles with the evil in this world is we're moving into self-righteousness. There's a lot of stuff on social media, people having opinions, drawing lines. But I find I also move into self-pity. Do you have any examples of either of those for yourself? I've got a couple as well, but what does that make you think of?
I mean, I think that my inner critic is really harsh. And so I find myself either saying I am an idiot or I'm no good or I'm not good enough or smart enough or whatever. And then, so that's the self-pity side, right? And then I find myself trying to go on the other, like kind of climb that scale or ladder with saying, finding things that I am good at and almost feeling proud of myself for them, and then going, wait a second, that's not right either. Like that, if I take that all the way, I think that's what keeps me stuck, because I'm afraid if I follow that trajectory, then I'll get a big head or I'll think I'm better than other people.
Yeah, which in Christianity is the worst.
Right, right, exactly.
Even though it's really not that bad. But for us, we've decided that's the worst thing.
Right, right. And so it's like, I can't go there. And so it really does keep me stuck. But then I think that the way out for me is when I realize that that's moving towards self-righteousness. I'm declaring that I'm righteous because of those human-sized things versus kind of punting on the whole equation, finding my worth in God, which sounds like an escapism, right? But trying to figure out how to take that reality, and it's not unrelated to the spectrum, that I can then look at the things I do well and enjoy them. It's like Max Licato's book, You Are Special. It's the stickers and dots and going, man, stickers do feel good. Or stars, I think stars and dots, whatever it is. Yeah, now I'm making it more confusing than it needs to be. But you can, it's not like the whole thing goes out the window. You don't pay attention to them, but the worth that's attached to those things. It's the self-righteousness or the self-pity that it kind of, you can get off of that treadmill.
So for me, I think the signs that I move into self-pity, I tend to leak to others the need to be noticed. That's what I'm noticing in myself. And particularly when I was a pastor full-time, I would find myself thinking, this is so hard. No one knows how hard this is. That's self-pity.
Yeah.
A lot of people have hard jobs.
Yeah.
But in that moment, no one has it harder than me, or that kind of idea.
Yeah.
So Elijah is the model of self-pity after he defeats Ahab on Mount Horeb. He self-isolates, and then he goes into self-pity. I'm always looking for that in my own life. That's the sign that I'm anxious. That'd be one thing. Self-righteousness for me, it's usually some form of, I'm looking for judgmentalism in myself. And I'm sorry to say both of them, that I've got, they're always an ever-present help in time of trouble. I'm always between self-pity and self-righteousness. So folks, as you're listening and as we're trying to help you relax into being human-sized and relax into the presence of God, one thing you might think about, this is deeper, is how is self-pity and self-righteousness in my life an attempted solution? And you're still in self. You're not connected to God. Well, Jimmy, hey, after all these years, we have a podcast sponsor, Seminary Now. SeminaryNow.com is a website where you can get so many great video courses. As you've looked at the website, Jimmy, what are a couple that grab your eye?
Yeah, I was looking at Roger Olson has one, The Mosaic of Christian Belief. And even without knowing any more about what he's going to go in there, just that idea of looking at scripture from a little bit zoomed out perspective, right? That, you know, how a mosaic, if you look too closely, it can feel disjointed and disconnected. So my assumption is that it's kind of looking at the different pieces and zooming out and looking at the beautiful picture that it creates. So that's exciting. And then really just the title of this one, Strengthening the Soul of Your Leadership by Ruth Haley Barton. Man, just this idea of, I think we look at leaders as machines sometimes, and to remember that each one of us have souls that need to be tended to, and just the strength that you can find in a leader who is tending to their own soul and also being a leader. You know, they're not just escaping somewhere to be with themselves, but they're bringing their full self into leadership. That's great.
Yeah. So Seminary Now is a subscription service that just gives you access to dozens and dozens of scholars and thinkers that help you grow in your faith, help you with your Bible understanding. I've actually got a course on there called Managing Anxiety. And if you go to seminarynow.com/cuss and then put in the coupon code CUSS30, you get 30% off your subscription. Okay, Jimmy, let's dig in a little deeper on attempted solutions in theology and in the Bible. I was thinking about it. Okay, if sin is the problem and sin is the recurring predictable problem, then hiding and blaming are the human attempted solutions.
Mm-hmm.
We'll do a whole episode down the road on second order change, but just for now, why don't we just say that attempted solutions are first order change. They feel like change, but they're not changing anything. And we learn in Genesis 3 that when humans sin, we have a temptation to hide or blame. It's actually one of my favorite things about systems theory is it has no interest in me blaming anyone. It only has interest in me looking at myself. got any Bible characters or stories in Scripture where you can think of, okay, here's the problem and here's the attempted solution?
I think over the course of several, I mean, that's one of the hard things with this is that if it's an attempted solution for a stuck pattern, it's not just, it's hard to pull one story out of the Bible and know whether it was stuck. But I think that one of the caricatures would be Peter and his boldness. I think that his boldness got him into a lot of trouble. Now it was a positive characteristic too.
It works some of the time.
Yeah, yeah. His boldness is what, you know, led him out to walk on water and these great examples. But I think the most common phrase that Jesus might have said to Peter was What Peter said to Jesus was "No, Lord."
Yeah, quite the oxymoron phrase.
Yeah, like right after he said, no, Lord.
Which
leads to, I'll take it from here, is kind of the stance that he takes. You know, when Jesus responds to him, "Get behind me, Satan," one time for his actions. And then he actually pulls out the sword to take off the ear of the guard in the garden. These examples of his boldness to try and take things into his own hands or believe that he knows what's best, got him into trouble.
It's a really good example because Peter, if he went through our class, be a bit awkward having the Pope in our class, but we'd get over it. But if he went through our class, he might be saying, "I'm serving the kingdom. Like, I'm boldly going in. Like, that's what God calls me to do." But what we're inviting people to do is reflect on if God's calling you to do it or if your anxiety is calling you to do it. You're suggesting that at least those examples, Peter was like impetuously bold rather than reflectively bold, I guess.
Yeah, it's tough. You know, all these things that we try and extrapolate from the Bible, right? Yeah. We could be dead wrong, of course, but it does seem that, you know, even when he denied Jesus, right, it doesn't seem like he was doing that tactically, you know, of like, oh, this isn't the right time. His caricature would have been to just, you know, hand a fist, you know, like, let's plow through, let's make sure that Jesus doesn't get crucified, yet he's there denying that he even knows the guy.
Yeah.
Which is why I think that's such a beautiful picture in the Bible where Jesus then three times, you know, almost heals that. And it's the same thing we talked about, Steve, of the spectrum of self-righteousness and self-pity, and almost like God's inviting us off of that treadmill.
Yeah.
And his boldness is not good or bad. It's that... it's good. I shouldn't say that it's not good or bad. Boldness can be good, but it really is looking at the qualities that we have and tempering them, I guess, maybe.
Yeah. I mean, I just keep getting hung up on I enjoy helping people, but my brain is untrustworthy on its own between my need to be needed and God calling me to help someone in need. Mm-hmm. I've just learned I can't trust my brain. I think that's what we're saying about Peter. His boldness is a gift unless he must always be bold. And now he's just anxious.
Yeah.
And he ends up drowning and telling Jesus, you know, being called Satan basically by Jesus. Not great. And then what's interesting about Peter, you bring him up. He obviously had quite a transformative experience with Jesus and then at Pentecost. Acts, the book of Acts seems to flip the percentages where his boldness seems more kingdom and only a couple of times he gets into trouble.
Yeah, it's like this transformative power of the gospel, right? Yeah. Is that the self-help section of the bookstore, we can make such small changes, I think, in our own, but when we invite God in to transform us, I think this is a kind of thing that we can hope for or expect of God doing in us.
Yeah, because God basically keeps us as who we are, but the aim is different, the motive. I'm thinking of Paul. You could say that before Paul was a Christian, his attempted solution was violent zeal.
Yeah.
And then after he encountered Christ, he was as zealous, but it was all like harnessed for kingdom. And he became this unbelievable, like zealous kingdom guy.
Right. But not perfection, right? Like if you look at, it was Paul who actually still called Peter into line.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't that Peter was... free of this, right? It was just that it was a marked change.
Yeah. All right. In the Old Testament, I was thinking, if we're thinking about predictable patterns, man, the book of Judges has a recurring phrase all through the book of Judges. In those days, Israel had no king and everyone did what was right in their own eyes. And you're suggesting that when Israel asked for a human king, God's like, you don't want that. That might be considered an attempted solution.
Yeah, because, I mean, things went really bad. I mean, not that that's the only evidence you need. But, I mean, God did say, like, you don't need a king, but okay. You know, if you want a king, I'll give you a king.
Give you
knowing
what you
that
want.
It's going to go poorly. And they just keep, you know, putting king after king in there, thinking that's their way towards what they want.
I've had a lot of fun with the book that, you know, it's not coming out till May, so we've got a while, but I've had a lot of fun looking at attempted solutions in the way we read our Bible, with my heart of it being that our love of our scriptures doesn't go down, but our more of the same and try harder goes away. And I talk about, you know, the temptation for us to open the book of Acts and see those incredible disciples and then use try harder and more of the same to be like them. But we're never going to be like them. I also enjoy I think one of the things we do, Jimmy, is we stack every Bible character. So Peter walked on water once, but we operate our life like we should always be walking, taking bold steps of faith. Mary sat at Jesus' feet contemplatively, and then we feel guilty. Oh, I'm not very contemplative. But we never see that whole way of thinking about Scripture is an attempted solution, because Peter did it one time. We expect ourselves to do it all time. Peter and Mary probably were not like each other at all. I'm going to roll the dice. Obviously, this is an assumption. I'm going to say if Mary was in the boat, she probably wouldn't have stepped out of it. She probably would have had to think about it. But we expect ourselves to be Mary 1 week, Peter 1 week, Paul 1 week, Esther 1 week. And we stack this fictional super disciple that I think is exhausting us.
Yeah.
Another thing I'll go after is, you know, the global persecutor church. I think the Western church, we look at how well we have it, we feel guilty, and then we apply more of the same and try harder to try to be more like the global persecutor church without any appreciation that our context is so radically different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's right.
All right. Well, let's move into how do you dissolve a stuck pattern? What tools do you have in your tool belt for this? You've noticed a stuck pattern. You've noticed your attempted solutions. Okay. How do you begin to dissolve a stuck pattern?
I mean, it's difficult to say things in generalities, but one of the ways that you can do it is by once you pay attention and notice it, just knowing that it's there can actually get you unstuck.
Okay.
Especially when you look at attempted solutions with the way that couples argue, let's say, you know, it's a recurring pattern of the topic changes every time, but the way they go about arguing is the same. Usually in those environments where both people want to be well, they want to resolve the stuck pattern, just naming the dynamic can take some of the power away out of it. Of when we both are noticing that we fall into these predictable patterns, then they have less of a grip on us. And so I think that that's not always that's the best case scenario, I guess, is when all you have to do is just notice and name the pattern.
Yeah.
And it dissolves, but it happens.
It's one of the most powerful things.
Yeah.
It's a classic marriage counseling move where if a couple comes in and they're fighting uncontrollably, the therapist will prescribe a fight. Okay, this Tuesday at 6 p.m., I want you guys to fight. And then it's always comical because the couple comes in the next week and they couldn't fight because they're so busy noticing the pattern they can't get wrapped. It's like they've become immune to getting wrapped up. And I used to work for a marriage therapist where I always wondered how he ever got referrals, because when the couple would come in and say, oh, we couldn't fight, it didn't work, he'd tell them off.
Yeah.
He'd be like, look, if you're not going to fight, I'm not going to waste my time.
You're not going to take this seriously.
Yeah. But of course, the whole thing is kind of a sting. But it's the simple idea that just by noticing a pattern, you're less likely to fall into it. I was thinking about, I was doing a Zoom with a group of students and a couple of pastors. And we had the students in Zoom groups, and it was just me and the pastors chatting while we were waiting. And one of them said, oh, I just wrapped up jury duty. And he was the foreman on a murder trial. And he said that it took a long time of deliberation, and all he kept doing was noticing the dynamic. Who's dominating who? Who's not speaking up? He even had this moment where he was pretty sure that somebody didn't feel safe to say what they really thought, and everyone wanted to go home, and he could feel the pressure to have kind of a appeasement.
Yeah.
But instead he did the counterintuitive move of inviting the person to say more. And the whole time he spent, I think it was a day and a half, he told me that they were in deliberations. He said that most of his energy was on just noticing the pattern so that he wouldn't get wrapped up into it. I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah. And Steve, I think I jumped ahead by going straight to that, naming the dynamic, because I think that before you can do that, the first thing to do is how you started the episode. It was the quote that Jay Haley says, he doesn't treat problems but attempted solutions. It's really paying attention to what am I doing? How am I complicit in keeping this stuck?
Yeah.
Right? Is taking a look at your own attempted solutions, but just behavior. Yeah. And what am I doing that's allowing this problem to continue?
Yeah. I mean, that was huge for me with my critics when I realized, because I would always blame them. Oh, how hard is it to be? I'm in self-pity, lead pastoring so hard. And then, wait a minute. Why do I keep meeting with them?
Yeah.
When what's going on there? And so there was that. I'm also thinking about, okay, why am I anxiously helping my kids get to school on time? What's the big deal? Why not let them get late and face the consequence?
Yeah.
Or what we ended up often doing with our kids. And this is a key point, Jimmy, because sometimes I'm always concerned that I make things sound simpler and longer lasting.
Right.
We would frequently talk to our kids about this pattern, and then things would get better for a few months, and then they get worse again. That's life.
Yeah.
But that was also something I would notice my complicity. And then when I talk to my kids, I'm not blaming them. I'm taking responsibility for my part and then giving them fair warning. Hey, just so you know, tomorrow I'm going to be the most relaxed cat in the room. I might watch a movie while you're anxiously getting ready. I'm being facetious here, but bringing some playfulness into it. But those simple things, noticing the dynamic and then naming your complicity, man, that's got to be 70 or 80% of it, I think.
Totally. And I think that what I've encountered as I've worked, you know, because as you take a particular scenario through this process, it's not quick. I think that we can make it sound like we can just notice a stuck problem and then snap our fingers and have a pathway out of it. But I mean, it can take time where you actually write all these things down, right?
Yeah.
You go through a process and you say, what is the problem for starters? Of just saying, you know, because one problem can be five problems.
Yeah, what problem do I think I'm trying to solve here?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so as I work with people to do this, what I find is that when we talk about your complicity, it'll run to, like you just gave the example of, if my kids are late, what will the staff of the school think of me?
Yeah.
Right? There's this value that I think that, at least my observation of you, Steve, is that I have learned a lot of a loosened grip or an open-handed grip about things. So I think that you might be, whether that's with work or wiring, it's something that I admire. Whereas somebody like me with a tight grip on things, I might find that I'm doing this being driven by what people think of me and not being willing to let go of it.
Yeah,
right?
It actually has little to do with your child being prompt.
Yes.
And more to do with your reputation.
Yeah. And so when you get to the end of those roads and you find that this is why I'm letting this problem go on, that's when you have to look it in the face and go, which do I want to deal with, right?
Yeah.
This recurring problem that happens all the time, or do I want to examine this thing, that this Armageddon scenario of what might happen if my kids are late? That's the territory that I think is difficult for some people to explore.
Yeah. It's always tricky when you have an epiphany on the air in a podcast, but I just had one. Like I've always felt stupid with home repair. It doesn't take much for me to feel very incompetent.
Mm.
Therefore, I'm not driving to Home Depot, because what if I can't fix the switch?
Yeah.
It's like, so even noticing that, well, now I can soberly decide. This is probably also an important thing, Jimmy. I can probably hit that switch another 300 times, and maybe I'll, but rather than getting caught up in it, that'll be a sober decision.
Yeah.
Or I can dig into my feeling of stupidity, manage it, and then replace a light switch. The last time I worked on electricity, I did get electrocuted. So, you know, that might also be a,
it could
a
be a factor.
Warning flag. Yeah. To be careful there. Yeah. Thought I had the right breaker turned off, and I didn't.
Well, you're welcome for bringing up, you know, the switch on this episode.
Okay, so then once you've named a dynamic, if you're trying to dissolve your attempt at solutions, you've named a dynamic, you've named your own complicity, you've gotten clear on what's actually driving it. Let's just have a quick chat about the power of curiosity. Mm-hmm. How does that help stay off the attempted solution treadmill?
Yeah, I think that my mind immediately goes to once you figure out the why, right? What is keeping me, you know, rushing my kids? And when you find out that, oh, it's because I'm afraid that people will judge me, it's the curiosity of fast-forwarding those scenarios and seeing how likely the Armageddon scenario is to happen. You know, that if they get to school once later, 10 times later, or whatever that is, what will they think? And how much is that going to impact the way that I show up every day? And it's not like saying, well, who cares what they think? And it's not an extreme reaction.
Yeah, right.
It's more right-sizing it and going, man, how I'm acting as though this is the worst thing that could happen. And it's maybe leveling the playing field a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. And even like this whole feeling of stupidity with home repair, the more curious I am about it, the less stupid I'm going to feel. That's what's also interesting about it. The final tool we'll share today, and then we'll wrap up. Sometimes you can reverse your attempted solution. This one's risky because sometimes it makes it worse, but oftentimes we will prescribe a reversal. I'm thinking of the intern we had in our leadership community where we teach these tools, where he was so terrified of making a mistake, we prescribed a mistake.
Yeah.
And in his case, it was you need to get the catering order completely wrong for the upcoming volunteer banquet. That's a reversal. You and I have done this too with people where sometimes if we notice, oh man, this person never speaks up, I'm going to quietly pull him aside or pull her aside before the meeting. I'm not going to call them out in the meeting. That's going to make it worse. But I'm going to say, hey, do me a favor. Can you share three times in this meeting? You know, that kind of thing. That would be a reversal.
Yeah.
Sometimes those can help break the pattern as well.
Yeah, and I think it's probably because the way that our minds work and our hearts work with information is different. You know, I think that we can give our minds new information and we can change our opinions, but our hearts learn experientially.
Yeah.
You know, and so this is kind of like one of those opportunities that you're kind of orchestrating an opportunity for your heart to learn a different reality.
Yeah.
I think.
Yeah, brave practice. Okay, folks, so that's four episodes on the four dynamics that infect every relationship. This is actually a whole chapter in my book coming out in May, but the reason we're doing these four dynamics, the reason we've spent so much time on them, is we want to help you in your most precious relationships. And in case you're wondering, your most precious relationships are with God, with yourself, with your people, and what the Bible would call with your enemies. We don't teach these tools just so you can have an enclave of people you like, but it's actually so you can be well with a broader range of people than you are now. And we include God on that list because where we're starting to take this show is helping us see the way these dynamics infect our faith. So you can go back and listen to these episodes. We'll be doing more tools like this, and we look forward to seeing you next time.
For more resources, visit stevecusswords.com or missyoualliance.org.